My guest today is Chris Smith, one of Portland's most prolific and dedicated transportation reform activists. He's been a candidate for Portland City Council and Metro Council. He's been a member of all types of boards and advisory committees over the years, including Portland Streetcar. He is co-founder of the nonprofit No More Freeways, and he spearheaded an update to Portland's bicycle parking code during his time as a member of the Portland Planning and Sustainability Commission. Chris Smith, welcome into the show.
Thank you, Jonathan.
And did I get anything wrong there? You've been involved in so many things. It makes introductions very hard.
You called No More Freeways a nonprofit. We're actually more of a political campaign. We do have a nonprofit sponsor, but No More Freeways itself is not a nonprofit.
Okay, good to know. Noted correction. All right. Let's talk about bike parking. I mentioned your work on it briefly in the intro, but tell me how you got started in bike parking and why it is such an important issue for you.
Yeah, well, I got connected to this through the last bicycle master plan process. Sam Adams appointed me to that steering committee in 2009, or maybe 2008, I don't remember. But I think he was looking for the connection to streetcar and kind of the transit bike connection, which I was able to provide. I helped write the chapter in the master plan about integration with other modes. But just as that process was wrapping up, before we even finished, Sam wound up appointing me to the Planning and Sustainability Commission. So one of the first things I got to vote on in the Planning and Sustainability Commission was the master plan when it came to it. So I kind of got to carry it through,
nice.
Which was nice. But looking at a lot of recommendations in that plan, a lot of them relate to facilities. I think that's the part people think about is what's the bike network look like. But that plan had a lot of different policy recommendations, including the need for end-of-trip facilities. So we know that kind of to be able to successfully cycle, you not only need good facilities to cycle on, you need end-of-trip facilities on either end so you can store your bicycle. And we've seen that secure storage continue to be a blocker. The Community Cycling Center has done a number of studies and continue to confirm that lack of secure bicycle storage is a hindrance to cycling. So I got on the Planning and Sustainability Commission, and it's like, well, I can do something about that.
Yeah, right.
And in fact, it was pretty early in my tenure that it came up. The city periodically does a process called RECAP, which is regulatory improvement something process. I forget exactly what it stands for. But it's where you make minor adjustments to the zoning code to kind of deal with problems that people are experiencing with the code. And in the 2010 version of that, shortly after it passed the master plan, they added bicycle parking to the agenda because we were at that time, the last round of bicycle code had been done in the 1990s. Mm-hmm. And the bicycle parking ratio for multifamily buildings was 0.25. So you had to put in one bicycle parking space for every four apartments.
Wow.
And what we were seeing was condos were going up in the central city and people would move in and suddenly it's like, where do I park my bicycle? And the developers had no idea because they didn't build enough bike parking. So people were shoving bicycles in any nook and cranny that they could. So there was a need to update that. And in that cycle, we updated the code to say 1.1, and that was based on some work Roger Geller had done on sort of the rate of ownership of bicycles. And actually, as that went, so the PSC recommended 1.1. As it went to council, the BTA actually came in and pushed for 1.5 in the central city. So that's when we kind of established the more modern ratios.
Okay, let me back you up there a quick. Roger Geller is the Portland Bureau of Transportation bicycle coordinator, so essentially in charge of planning all the bike-related stuff. BTA is the name of what the Street Trust is now. They used to be the Bicycle Transportation Alliance, right?
Right.
And you mentioned PSC, which is the Planning and Sustainability Commission.
Yeah.
And so you're talking right now about 2010, 2011, right? When you started to do this regulatory change on the bike parking and the ratios then. So, and when you talk about ratio, can you just explain what that means, that 1.5 that you'd arrived at? What does that actually mean?
Sure. So it's the ratio between the number of living units in a multifamily building, either a condo or apartment building, rental or ownership, and the number of bicycle parking spaces. And probably a good place to eject the idea that the ratios are not the only important thing. The standards are also important. So what constitutes a usable bicycle parking space and what are you required to do in the code? And one of the things we started to tweak in 2009 or 2010 was the idea of parking a bicycle inside the living unit, which has been an artifact of Portland's code for a long time. We have always to some degree allowed the bicycle parking to be in the living unit, which I am personally dubious about how effective that is. But interestingly, a lot of people seem to want to store their bicycle where they live. I mean, there's security concerns, obviously. That's one of the things I'd love feedback from your readers, because it was an open question in 2019. I think it's still an open question that gets exacerbated by some of the recent developments, as we'll talk about. But prior to that update in 2010, there was no standard for how you stored the bicycle in the unit. So developers would essentially say, well, we've got room for one bicycle in every living unit. That takes care of our obligation. They didn't really have to do anything. So in 2010, we added the idea, well, you at least have to have a hook on the wall and show us where the bicycle parking is. So that was kind of the first attempt at updating that. And you'll see we came back to that later on. So, but from 2010 to 2019, we lived with basically a 1.1 ratio for most of the city, 1.5 for the central city. And there was not a lot of pushback to that. So it's interesting to see how the pushback developed later. But there's still a lot of deficiencies in the code in terms of standards for bike rooms and security and other things. So there was a need to take a comprehensive look. And when I got on the PSC, I started pushing for that. And as you know, that was not a quick process. Yeah, we had a wonk night back in the early teens. I don't remember exactly what year that was, but it was at least 6 years from that until we passed the code in 2019. So it was, yeah, you basically had to get two bureaus to put it in their joint work plans to do this package. And then we went through a whole stakeholder committee process in PBOT around the rules. And again, when it turned into code writing in the Bureau of Planning, we got to do the whole sequence of a discussion draft and a recommended draft and finally getting it adopted. So, you know, I was using my position in the PSC to make sure we didn't forget to do all that we kept it moving. So it was a place where I could use the small amount of power as you get as a planning and sustainability commissioner to actually, you know, keep the ball rolling forward. And in 2019, as you know, we crossed the goal line and we did a few important things there. We tweaked the ratios a little bit. So instead of 1.5 for the central city, it was 1.5 for all of the what Portland calls inner pattern areas. So we have, I think, four different pattern areas in the city. The two outermost pattern areas in East Portland and Southwest Portland, we set the ratio at 1.1. We kept it at 1.1, but we increased kind of the whole inner east side out to the 82nd or so to 1.5. But at the same time, we really zeroed in on the bike room standards to make sure that the bike room parking was really usable. And I think that's what generated some of the heat. We can talk about that. We tried to address the in-unit parking because, again, we really didn't believe it was effective. So first, we tried to eliminate it. And then the stakeholder process, the affordable housing developers came forward and said, no, we need to keep this or it's just not affordable for us to include bike parking. So we compromised and we said no more than 50% can be in unit. So you've got to have half your parking in bike rooms and you really have to have a usable space. And we developed what's come to be known as the alcove standard, where you had to have kind of a space where you could show where the bike went that wasn't just a hook on the wall. That had to be like a little closet or something.
Yeah, and that was that's because people were building there'd be a hook next to the TV or hook next to a bed or just be a hook.
Yeah, we
just
have some great pictures of hooks over couches and beds.
Yeah, okay.
And it had to be within 15 feet of the door was the other requirement. So we got that adopted in 2019, and it was in effect until recently with the regulatory relief project. But developers really pushed back on that. And as you'll recall, in the regulatory relief process, we got a lot of anecdotes of, we had to put X less living units in the building because we had to conform with the bicycle parking code. And I think that's probably real to a degree. And we're certainly in the middle of a housing crunch, so a housing crisis, let's call it that, because that's what it is. We don't have nearly as much housing in the city or the region as we need. So the economics of bike parking really got called into question, as well as the spatial dimensions. How did it impact the building? And we had done things to minimize the impact of the building. So we said, for example, that bike rooms don't count towards the overall square footage limits on a building. So if it wasn't like you were directly trading off space, but there's still the dollars to build the space and the way the floor plans worked and all that, there's still some practical limitations.
So just to kind of like put it, just to kind of get people up to speed on the kind of where we're at in this, those new reforms that were some pretty significant updates to the bike parking requirements, they passed in 2019, went into effect in 2020. And then fast forward, they were in effect for essentially 3 years. Uh-huh. And the commissioner in charge of the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, Commissioner Carmen Rubio, facing a lot of pressure for housing production, as folks can understand why. And she started to look at all the codes that were passed, all the codes that govern building of housing. And that's where the bike parking thing started to bubble up, right? There was this survey sent out to people that have construction permits and other folks involved in the production of housing. And right at the top of the list of things where they said, what is making it, what is this, what is the most onerous part of getting these housing units built? They actually put bike parking requirements as the number one thing. So we can debate whether or not that survey was sort of accurately capturing people's feelings or what. But the bottom line was it became this sort of hot button thing.
Yep.
We were the talking point, right? It's like bike parking is terrible for housing production. Headline. But I mean, it also is worth saying that there was some really valid criticism, I think. And I think you might have touched on it just with spatial concerns. And of course, you and I are you especially are often working in the policy realm where you're talking about words in a code. But then people that are implementing this stuff down at design review office or the permit office, and they actually have human people over there trying to tell them what they can and can't build and how they can build it and can't build it. This stuff can get, I think maybe one of the lessons we had here is this stuff can get pretty complicated and very troublesome. And we had somebody who was actually on the board of the Street Trust, was one of the biggest critics of the bike parking requirements. And I think probably had something to do with swaying the adoption at Planning Commission ultimately of rolling them back. But I don't want to get ahead of you a little bit there. So take us through where Commissioner Rubio said, hey, we've got to look at this. It's clearly an issue. And then what happened from there?
Right. Well, it got really interesting politically for me because had two groups that I consider myself sort of members of in an at-large sense, the bicycle community and the pro-housing community, which some circles are called YIMBYs as opposed to NIMBYs, but the organization is Portland Neighbors Welcome, which I am a member of. I'm a member of Bike Loud, who said, what, you're going to take away our parking? Come on. So I actually spent some energy trying to make sure those two groups didn't go at each other's throats and help them get together on a joint letter, which essentially said, okay, we understand that the ratios are set so that we're building the parking for the bike riders who will come along in 2030 and 2035 and 2040. And maybe we can't afford to do that right now when housing economics aren't penciling out. So working on the ratios probably makes some sense because it's a decision of whether you invest for the future at the expense of the now, and we're probably in the wrong balance point. So I was supportive of tweaking the ratios, and I wrote a piece on your blog about that. And where we wound up with Bike Loud and Portland Neighbors Welcome is a joint letter that said, yeah, okay, we understand you need to do this, but you're blowing up some things that are probably going to have some side effects we don't like. And one of them was getting rid of the alcove standard. So we're back to a hook on the wall. And the letter requested follow-up to basically address that and see if we could come up with a better standard for in-unit parking that didn't have all the problems that the alcove standard had. The other thing that got, so the ratios got tweaked down. So instead of 1.5 and 1.1, they go to 1.0 and 0.7 in the outer pattern areas. And that's in effect for 5 years. So that's got a sunset built in, so it's not forever. And to my mind, kind of makes sense in terms of balancing the economics, and we hope we're in a better place in 5 years. But the alcove standard went away permanently, and I think that's going to be a problem because if half the parking we build is ineffective in unit parking, then we're, it's more like we have 0.5 left, right? And the other thing that was taken away was a standard we put in that a small percentage in large buildings had to be larger cargo bike spaces.
Right.
I think 4 by 10 feet for a front loader or a tricycle, something like that. You and I ride long tail cargo bikes that we can hook up to a staple. That's not a problem. But if you've got a front loader or a trike, you really need a bigger space. So that was eliminated again with that 5-year sunset. So for 5 years, we're not requiring building spaces for cargo bikes. And I think we got to have a public policy discussion about where those go. So as I was getting ready to go back to the Bureau and say, okay, we've got some community agreement that we're moving forward, but we need to do some follow-up. What can we do about that? Then Senate Bill 1537 came along, which is started as the governor's housing package. It got modified quite a bit in the legislature. But one of the sections of that, Section 38, is a series of so-called automatic adjustments that developers can ask for. And one of those is around bicycle parking, and it would take the ratio down to 0.5. And this will, I think this is passed, and we're just waiting for the governor to sign it, which I don't think there's any doubt that she will. The other thing it does is it generally doesn't affect the standards except in one way, and that is it has a provision that the bicycle parking can be anywhere on or adjacent to the building site. And I haven't, I'm doing some research on how this got in there, because when the governor's package came out last year, it didn't pass because of some of the land use issues. It was a 1.0 ratio that they were talking about. So I missed the shift from 1.0 to 0.5. And obviously, if I'd paid attention, I would have gotten involved in this earlier. But then also this location requirement, because I have never really heard anyone complain about a problem of where the bike parking can be located. And in Portland, what we say is basically, we all have it to be in the unit. The bike rooms, the only thing we say about bike rooms is they have to be accessible by ramp or elevator. So you could put a bike room on every floor if you want. And some people would say that's the right model. I want the bike close to my living unit. But what we're saying is you can't make somebody lug their bike up or down a set of stairs. The new state language would appear to allow that. The other problem with the state language is it makes no distinction between long-term and short-term parking. So you could put the visitor parking on the loading dock, where it wouldn't make any sense. And we have some rules about the location for visitor parking, and the state law just completely peanut butters those things together. So I have some concerns about that. So we're in the middle of the end of session, so nobody's really got time to dive into this, and I caught it too late to offer any amendments. So I'm going to be connecting with some legislators who worked on this after the session to kind of figure out whose needs they were trying to address with that, and see if we can answer that. But it would be, if it stays as is, it would be pretty devastating, I think, for the kind of parking that gets built. There is a provision that cities can get out of the automatic adjustment section if they jump through certain hoops. So I have not heard yet if the city of Portland is going to try and do that. I would hope that that's the case, in which case this may be a non-issue. But I find the pushback against bike parking to be an interesting sort of big public policy question. Why do people feel that this is the thorn in their side? Why do they feel the need to put in such stringent stuff in the state law? And I think there's a public policy question to raise that, okay, if we don't think it's appropriate to pay for bike parking as part of putting up a building, where should we be parking? And, different places have come different answers to that. In Amsterdam, you see a lot of district bike parking. So you'll see, in some cases, they're underground garages, right, where you park bicycles. In other cases, I've seen a storefront that everybody in the neighborhood parks their bicycle in that storefront, and they've all got a shared key. So should we be thinking more about doing district bike parking? There's a product in Europe you've probably seen called a cycle hoop, which looks like a little Quonset hut for bikes that you you put in the parking strip, right?
When I was in New York City recently, I did some reporting on Unipod, which is another similar kind of thing, another take on that, which is like these neighborhood little hubs where you would park securely. Oh, you moved right into the state bill SB 1537, which is Kotek's big housing bill, and there's definitely some stuff there that I wanted to talk about with both of these things, but just in terms of this pushback on bike parking. So basically, we had this significant upgrade in the bike parking requirements, right, that we worked on for a long time, and they were in there for 3 years. It got rolled back pretty significantly just in February, actually, right, as the final council action on that, where they, like you described, they rolled that all back. And then all of a sudden, the state has a A similar situation with the urgency to build more housing. Governor Kotek says it's her biggest priority. And then this bill comes along and there's this bike parking provision in there, which to me was like, I mean, first of all, I didn't know about it until you flagged it a week or so ago. But we didn't hear anybody talk about that. It just kind of happened. It seems to me that that wouldn't have been in there without what happened in Portland. And maybe some people just kind of adopted that or thought that that's what we need to do, because as Portland often does, is it becomes sort of it can become a model to inspire other folks. And I wonder if we sort of help clear the way for someone down in Salem just to pop that in there.
Yeah, I think we may have created the idea it's politically acceptable to push back on bike parking. Some people saw it as a green light. But again, I need to investigate who the stakeholders were, because I don't know. Now, the good news is a lot of our standards stay intact. So even though we lost the in-unit standard in Portland, all the bike room standards still apply, even if it is at a lower ratio. So at least we're getting some usable bike room parking. I have heard some pushback in the bicycle community among kind of the industry folks that our bike room standards may have been too generous, that the bike rooms built under those codes take up more space than they need to for effective bike parking. So I've got to spend some time talking to them and seeing if there's dimensional relief we can provide.
That makes me think of something else I want to bring up, which was how much of this has to do with sort of just the shift in the narrative around cycling in general, right? I mean, a lot of these new requirements got put in when cycling was really ascendant, when it was on the upswing, when it was the first thing out of everybody's mouth at City Hall. And it hasn't been like that for several years. And so we're seeing these requirements are being rolled back. And it's sort of like, it also reminds me, like, no one really fought this that I heard about. No bike activists. I didn't really hear anybody saying, hey, you're taking away our bike parking. So I feel like I'm trying to tease out how much of this is politics and how much of this has to do with just like narrative stuff, and or how much of it has to do with it actually being bad for housing production versus something that we know anytime people see the word bike, it can often just be an easy scapegoat. So it's really interesting how this is happening at the same time where cycling, at least the headlines say, is kind of on the downswing a bit. So
the timing is interesting, because of course we started this, or at least I started my advocacy within the Planning Bureau coming off the master plan, which was kind of the high point, right? That was the zenith.
Right.
And even though it took us until 2019 and mode share was trending down a little bit, we were still kind of rolling off all the recommendations from that 2010 master plan and kind of hitting the political reality this year.
Yeah, I think a lot of it's interesting as I think about what's happened, the trajectory of these bike parking requirements. I've thought a lot about how these overlapping crises we face in cities, from policing to racial reckoning to housing to homelessness, all these things, how those have really notched down transportation as like a central issue in politics. This bicycle parking regulation thing is like maybe just a really excellent illustration of that. The fact that we would reduce it and roll back some of this stuff that was fought so hard for and made such a strong case for, it would be rolled back. And then in the case of the state language, just happened without anybody even knowing about it, without any discussion at all, is pretty striking to me. And I just wonder kind of what you think about that.
Yeah, well, I think with SB 1537, probably part of the problem was the big fight in that bill was the exemptions to the urban growth boundary process, right? So everyone's attention was drilled in.
Yeah.
We're going to have exemptions to the UGB. I can understand why nobody was looking at the bike parking in Section 38.
Yeah, of course.
But I still wish I had paid more attention.
Yeah, I was looking at some of the testimony from some folks that oppose SB 1537 and doing my alt F for the word bicycle parking and not seeing anything. So definitely no one was thinking about it, which makes sense, right? I mean, in some ways, to me, one of the frustrations of being a bicycle advocate person has been it's been very humbling these last few years to realize that there are much more important things for us and for people to focus on. I think the production of housing absolutely trumps in many ways the abilities to bike to that housing, let's say. But I wonder if you have any thoughts about how we can be smarter about this going forward, whether or not we have to have this choice. Is it a choice between housing production or bike parking, and how can we avoid that going forward?
Yeah. I think, maybe one lesson I've learned is that the 2019 package is kind of a gold-plated package. We it was our first shot since the 1990s. We went for it and we were successful in landing it, and maybe we overreached a little bit. And I think we have, you know, room to go back and tweak that a little bit with some of the bike room standards and whatnot, but maybe we overshot a bit. But yeah, you know, it's still the case that our comprehensive plan calls for us to have a 25% bicycle mode share by 2030. And the fact that we are not getting that mode share has some pretty devastating consequences in terms of traffic congestion in the city, right? And if we don't get there eventually, we have to spend a lot more money on roads, money that we don't have. And I can't unlink this in my mind with the other thing I'm working on, which is the $1 billion of general fund that got allocated to the interstate bridge replacement, which, if you want to talk about misallocation of resources, it swamps the bike parking issue by like three or four orders of magnitude.
Yeah, right.
But they're probably two sides of the same coin in some ways.
Yeah, yeah. I noticed when the Portland Planning Commission passed the recent change to roll back the local one, there were definitely mixed feelings. There are people on there that understood that what they were doing in reversing some of the really pro biking policies. And there was I think one of the commissioners said something to the effect of, we don't think we should wait the 5 years that it says actually in the language now. We're hoping we can revisit this sooner. Do you have any faith that there will be an opportunity to bring up bike parking sooner than later? I mean, especially with the whole entire council change that's going to happen in Portland with a bunch of new councilors and maybe more people that could spend some time on the policy side of this. Any idea, like, if you think it'll get talked about sooner and when?
So I hope, and I'll be advocating for addressing some of the standards issues before that. So the in-unit parking standard, the what do we do about cargo bikes question. I'm a little bit dubious that we can revisit the ratios before the 5 years, just because of the real impact on housing economics. You know, I wish I could believe we'd be out of the housing crisis in 5 years. I don't, given how many units were down compared to where we need to be, I don't know that I really believe that we will be. Mm. So I'm much more focused on the standards and making sure that what we build is effective. Now the state standard, the state ratio at 0.5, that would be devastating. So I am going to look for ways to get around that. But in terms of the city's pullback from 1.5 to 1.0, I think I can be patient and wait for the 5 years to run out.
Okay, I'm glad you mentioned the state thing, because before you leave, I want to make sure I get you to answer this, which is, can you help me understand how the new state language for SB 1537, how exactly will that integrate or impact with Portland's bike parking code? Or does it trump it? What parts of that? What's the ultimate impact of the new state law?
So I believe it trumps it. But in terms of how and whether it will get invoked is the question, and I need to get smarter about this. But basically, it's a laundry list. There's a laundry list of different adjustments is the language that they're using. So you make adjustments to local code, and you know, there are probably a couple dozen different adjustments listed. It says a developer can ask for any 10 of these.
Okay.
Will bike parking be the first thing they ask for? We'll get some validation of that survey, right? In the survey, they put it number one. Where will it be on the list when the actual have to figure out the dollars for the thing they're building? Will bike parking be at the top or not? It'll be interesting. But then there's also this several methods by which cities can get themselves out of this automatic adjustment process. So need to figure out the city of Portland is going to try and avail themselves of that, because I think we are probably not the worst in providing adjustments where needed compared to some other cities. So I don't know how much that Section 38 was targeted at Portland versus other cities.
Chris, is there anything else that you want our folks to know about bike parking right now, or any other issue that you're working on?
I'm still fascinated by the bike room versus in the unit question.
Okay.
Who wants to store their bike in their apartment versus in a bike room, and why? Because to me, it seems like the vast majority of people, at least cycling for transportation, would want to be in a bike room. You have a $10,000 racing bike, sure, you might want to put that next to your bed. I can understand that. But for folks who are cycling for transportation, what do people really think about that?
Okay, yeah, we can pose that on the site. I just think that the theft thing is probably the number one driver of that that feeling of wanting it in your room.
Right.
That for sure. I mean, and also maybe that it's not only $10,000 isn't just a racing bike these days. Some of these e-bikes get pretty expensive. So they're quite an investment for folks. And unfortunately, I think until these developers figure out how to make bike rooms more secure and not open to theft like they've been getting, it's just tricky, right? Because we're trying to make policy that encourages more bicycling, and it's being hurt by this sort of unrelated thing of high crime and theft, right, which we should also get fixed with other code and other advocates and other activism over here. Because until we do, it's going to poison the well of like how we talk about whether we want to have the bikes in our room or in a bike room. But I hear what you're saying. Is that being kind of a key issue in terms of the room or in?
Yeah. So some of the good standards survive. So that's the optimistic view on this whole thing, is we've attacked some of the ratios, but a lot of the good standards are still there.
Yeah. I guess that's a good vote for the importance of the gold plated thing that you mentioned, which is the super, super deluxe package. There were so many good things. This more cursory look at it that Rubio's office could do didn't quite get at all of them. So some of them still survived.
Yeah. Well, I know I talked with some of the city staff when that process was happening, and it was pretty clear that their directive was, take a hatchet to things, not a scalpel.
Right.
So they were going for the big, obvious, reductions that they could get.
Well, that's good. Your work is definitely really appreciated on this and all the other stuff that you're doing, Chris. And I really appreciate you sharing it with us here on Bike Portland. So thanks for chatting.
Well, and I always appreciate the opportunity to share my thoughts with your readers. So thank you.
That was planning advocate and bicycle parking expert Chris Smith. I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, please make sure to subscribe and leave a comment and tell your friends about it, and make sure you don't miss any future episodes. Really appreciate all of your support. If you are not a paid subscriber of Bike Portland yet, please become one today at bikeportland.org/support and find out how you can be a part of what we're doing here and pay a little bit in to keep it thriving and surviving. I also want to thank Brock Dittus of Sprocket Podcast fame for our wonderful new theme music. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, we'll see you in the streets.